Ladies and gentlemen, join us now for a Radio Lillooet special presentation of Jacob Abbott's Peter the Great in 7 parts.
Chapter 17 of Peter the Great. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Peter the Great by Jacob Abbott. Chapter 17, The Trial, 1717 to 1718. As soon as Alexis arrived in the country, his father issued a manifesto in which he gave a long and full account of his son's misdemeanors and crimes, and of the patient and persevering, but fruitless efforts which he himself had made to reclaim him, and announced his determination to cut him off from the succession to the crown as wholly and hopelessly irreclaimable. This manifesto was one of the most remarkable documents that history records. It concluded with deposing Alexis from all his rights as son and heir to his father, and appointing his younger brother, Peter, the little son of Catherine, as inheritor in his stead, and finally laying the paternal curse upon Alexis if he ever thereafter pretended to, or in any way, claim the succession of which he had been deprived. This manifesto was issued as soon as Peter learned that Alexis had arrived in the country under the charge of the officers who had been appointed to bring him, and before the Tsar had seen him. Alexis continued his journey to Moscow, where the Tsar then was. When he arrived, he went that same night to the palace, and there had a long conference with his father. He was greatly alarmed and overawed by the anger which his father expressed, and he endeavored very earnestly, by expressions of penitence and promises of amendment, to appease him. But it was now too late. The ire of the Tsar was thoroughly aroused, and he could not be appeased. He declared that he was fully resolved on deposing his son, as he had announced in his manifesto, and that the necessary steps for making the act of deposition in a formal and solemn manner, so as to give it full legal validity as a measure of state, would be taken on the following day. It must be confessed that the agitation and anger which Peter now manifested were not wholly without excuse, for the course which Alexis had pursued had been the means of exposing his father to a great and terrible danger, to that, namely, of a rebellion among his subjects. Peter did not even know but that such a rebellion was already planned and was ripe for execution, and that it might not break out at any time, notwithstanding his having succeeded in recovering possession of the person of Alexis and in bringing him home. Of such a rebellion, if one had been planned, the name of Alexis would have been, of course, the watchword and rallying point, and Peter had a great deal of ground for apprehension that such a one had been extensively organized and was ready to be carried into effect. He immediately set himself at work to ferret out the whole affair, resolving, however, in the first place, to disable Alexis himself from doing any further mischief by destroying finally and forever all claims on his part to the inheritance of the crown. Accordingly, on the following morning, before daybreak, the garrison of the city were put under arms, and a regiment of the guards was posted around the palace so as to secure all the gates and avenues, and orders were sent at the same time to the principal ministers, nobles, and councillors of state to repair to the great hall in the castle, and to the bishops and clergy to assemble in the cathedral. Everybody knew that the occasion on which they were convened was that they might witness the disinheriting of the prince imperial by his father, in consequence of his vices and crimes, and in coming together in obedience to the summons, the minds of all men were filled with solemn awe, like those of men assembling to witness an execution. When the appointed hour arrived, the great bell was tolled, and Alexis was brought into the hall of the castle, where the nobles were assembled, bound as a prisoner and deprived of his sword. The Tsar himself stood at the upper end of the hall, surrounded by the chief officers of state. Alexis was brought before him. As he approached, he presented a writing to his father, and then fell down on his knees before him, apparently overwhelmed with grief and shame. The Tsar handed the paper to one of his officers who stood near, and then asked Alexis what it was that he desired. Alexis, in reply, begged that his father would have mercy upon him and spare his life. The Tsar said that he would spare his life and forgive him for all his treasonable and rebellious acts, on condition that he would make a full and complete confession, without any restriction or reserve, of everything connected with his late escape from the country, explaining fully all the details of the plan which he had formed, and revealed the names of all his advisers and accomplices. But if his confession was not full and complete, if he suppressed or concealed anything, or the name of any person concerned in the affair, or privy to it, then this promise of pardon should be null and void. The Tsar also said that Alexis must renounce the succession to the crown, and must confirm the renunciation by a solemn oath, and acknowledge it by signing a declaration in writing to that effect with his own hand. To all this, Alexis, who seemed overwhelmed with contrition and anguish, solemnly agreed, and declared that he was ready to make a full and complete confession. The Tsar then asked his son who it was that advised him and aided him in his late escape from the kingdom. Alexis seemed unwilling to reply to this question in the midst of such an assemblage, but said something to his father in a low voice, which the others could not hear. In consequence of what he thus said, his father took him into an adjoining room, and there conversed with him in private for a few minutes, and then both returned together into the public hall. It is supposed that while they were thus apart, Alexis gave his father the names of some of those who had aided and abetted him in his absconding, for immediately afterward, three couriers were dispatched in three different directions, as if with orders to arrest the persons who were thus accused. As soon as Alexis and his father had returned into the hall, the document was produced, which the prince was to sign, renouncing the succession to the crown. The signature and seal of Alexis were affixed to this document with all due formality. Then a declaration was made on the part of the Tsar, stating the reasons which had induced his majesty to depose his eldest son from the succession, and to appoint his younger son, Peter, in his place. This being done, all the officers present were required to make a solemn oath on the Gospels, and to sign a written declaration, of which several copies had previously been prepared, importing that the Tsar, having excluded from the crown his son Alexis, and appointed his son Peter his successor in his stead, they own the legality and binding force of the decree, acknowledge Peter as the true and rightful heir, and bound themselves to stand by him with their lives against any or all who should oppose him, and declared that they never would, under any pretense whatsoever, adhere to Alexis, or assist him in recovering the succession. The whole company then repaired to the cathedral, where the bishops and other ecclesiastics were assembled, and there the whole body of the clergy solemnly took the same oath and subscribed the same declaration. The same oath was also afterward administered to all the officers of the army, governors of the provinces, and other public functionaries throughout the empire. When these ceremonies at the palace and at the cathedral were concluded, the company dispersed. Alexis was placed in confinement in one of the palaces in Moscow, and none were allowed to have access to him except those whom the Tsar appointed to keep him in charge. Immediately after this, the necessary proceedings for a full investigation of the whole affair were commenced in a formal and solemn manner. A series of questions were drawn up and given to Alexis, that he might make out deliberate answers to them in writing. Grand courts of investigation and inquiry were convened in Moscow, the great dignitaries both of church and state being summoned from all parts of the empire to attend them. These persons came to the capital in great state, and in going to and fro to attend at the halls of judgment from day to day, they moved through the streets with such a degree of pomp and parade as to attract great crowds of spectators. As fast as the names were discovered of persons who were implicated in Alexis's escape, or who were suspected in complicity in it, officers were dispatched to arrest them. Some were taken from their beds at midnight, without a moment's warning, and shut up in dungeons in a great fortress at Moscow. When questioned, if they seemed inclined to return evasive answers, or to withhold any information of which the judges thought they were possessed, they were taken into the torturing room and put to the torture. One of the first who was arrested was Alexander Kikin, who had been Alexis's chief confidant and adviser in all his proceedings. Kikin had taken extreme precautions to guard against having his agency in the affair found out, but Alexis, in the answers that he gave to the first series of questions that were put to him, betrayed him. Kikin was aware of the danger, and, in order to secure for himself some chance of escape in case Alexis should make disclosures implicating him, had bribed a page, who was always in close attendance upon the Tsar, to let him know immediately in case of any movement to arrest him. The name of this page was Baklanovsky. He was in the apartment at the time that the Tsar was writing the orders for Kikin's arrest, standing, as was his wont, behind the chair of the Tsar, so as to be ready at hand to convey messages or to wait upon his master. He looked over and saw the order which the Tsar was writing. He immediately contrived some excuse to leave the apartment, and hurrying away, he went to the post house and sent on an express by post to Kikin at Petersburg to warn him of the danger. But the Czar, noticing his absence, sent someone off after him, and thus his errand at the post house was discovered, but not until after the express had gone. Another express was immediately sent off with the order for Kikin's arrest, and both the couriers arrived in Petersburg very nearly at the same time. The one, however, who brought the warning was a little too late. When he arrived, the house of the commissioner was surrounded by a guard of 50 grenadiers, and officers were then in Kikin's apartment taking him out of his bed. They put him at once in irons and took him away, scarcely allowing him time to bid his wife farewell. The page was, of course, arrested and sent to prison too. A number of other persons, many of whom were of very high rank, were arrested in a similar manner. The arrival of Alexis at Moscow took place early in February, and nearly all of February and March were occupied with these arrests and the proceedings of the court in trying the prisoners. At length, toward the end of March, a considerable number, Kikin himself being among them, were condemned to death and executed in the most dreadful manner in a great and public square in the center of Moscow. One was impaled alive, that is, a great stake was driven through his body into the ground, and he was left in that situation to die. Others were broken on the wheel. One, a bishop, was burnt. The heads of the principal offenders were afterward cut off and set up on poles at the four corners of a square enclosure made for the purpose, the impaled body lying in the middle. The page who had been bribed by Kikin was not put to death. His life was spared, perhaps on account of his youth, but he was very severely punished by scourging. During all this time, Alexis continued to be confined to his prison, and he was subjected to repeated examinations and cross-examinations in order to draw from him not only the whole truth in respect to his own motives and designs in his flight, but also such information as might lead to the full development of the plans and designs of the party in Russia who were opposed to the government of Peter, and who had designed to make use of the name and position of Alexis for the accomplishment of their schemes. Alexis had promised to make a full and complete confession, but he did not do so. In the answers to the series of questions which were first addressed to him, he confessed as much as he thought was already known, and endeavored to conceal the rest. In a short time, however, many things that he had at first denied or evaded were fully proved by other testimony taken in the trial of the prisoners who have already been referred to. Then Alexis was charged with the omissions or evasions in his confession, which had thus been made to appear, and asked for an explanation, and thereupon he made new confessions, acknowledging the newly discovered facts, and excusing himself for not having mentioned them before, by saying that he had forgotten them, or else that he was afraid to divulge them, for fear of injuring the persons that would be implicated by them. Thus he went on contradicting and involving himself more and more by every fresh confession, until, at last, his father and all the judges who had convened to investigate the case ceased to place any confidence in anything that he said, and lost almost all sympathy for him in his distress. The examination was protracted through many months. The result of it, on the whole, was that it was fully proved that there was a powerful party in Russia opposed to the reforms and improvements of the Tsar, and particularly to the introduction of the European civilization into the country, who were desirous of effecting a revolution, and who wished to avail themselves of the quarrel between Alexis and his father to promote their schemes. Alexis was too much stupefied by his continual drunkenness to take any very active or intelligent part in these schemes, but he was more or less distinctly aware of them, and in the offers which he had made to enter a monastery and renounce all claims to the crown, he had been utterly insincere, his only object having been to blind his father by means of them and gain time. He acknowledged that he had hated his father, and had wished for his death, and when he fled to Vienna it was his intention to remain until he could return and take possession of the empire in his father's place. He, however, solemnly declared that it was never his intention to take any steps himself toward that end during his father's lifetime, though he admitted at last, when the fact had been pretty well proved against him by other evidence, that in case an insurrection in his behalf had broken out in Russia, and he had been called upon, he should have joined the rebels. A great deal of information, throwing light upon the plans of Alexis and of the conspirators in Russia connected with him, was obtained from the disclosures made by Afrosinia. As has already been stated, she had been taken by Alexis as a slave, and forced against her will to join herself to him and to follow his fortunes. He had never admitted her into his confidence, but had induced her from time to time to act as he desired by telling her any falsehood which would serve the purpose. She consequently was not bound to him by any ties of honor or affection, and felt herself at liberty to answer freely all questions which were put to her by the judges. Her testimony was of great value in many points, and contributed very essentially toward elucidating the whole affair. End of chapter 17. Peter the Great by Jacob Abbott. Chapter 18. The Condemnation and Death of Alexis. 1718. The examinations and investigations described in the last chapter were protracted through a period of several months. They were commenced in February and were not concluded until June. During all this time, Alexis had been kept in close confinement, except when he had been brought out before his judges for the various examinations and cross-examinations to which he had been subjected, and as the truth in respect to his designs became more and more fully developed, and the danger in respect to the result increased, he sank gradually into a state of distress and terror almost impossible to be conceived. The tribunals before whom he was tried were not the regular judicial tribunals of the country. They were, on the other hand, two grand convocations of all the great official dignitaries of the church and of the state that were summoned expressly for this purpose, not to decide the case, for, according to the ancient custom of the Russian Empire, that was the sole and exclusive province of the Tsar, but to aid him in investigating it, and then, if called upon, to give him their counsel in respect to the decision of it. One of these assemblies consisted of the ecclesiastical authorities, the archbishops, the bishops, and other dignitaries of the church. The other was composed of nobles, ministers of state, officers of the army and navy in high command, and other great civil and military functionaries. These two assemblies met and deliberated in separate halls, and pursued their investigations in respect to the several persons implicated in the affair, as they were successively brought before them, under the direction of the Tsar, though the final disposal of each case rested, it was well understood, with him alone. At length, in the month of June, when all the other cases had been disposed of, and the proof in respect to Alexis was considered complete, the Tsar sent in a formal address to each of these conventions, asking for their opinion and advice in respect to what he ought to do with his son. In his address to the archbishops and bishops, he stated that, although he was well aware that he had himself absolute power to judge his son for his crimes, and to dispose of him according to his own will and pleasure, without asking advice of anyone, still, as men were sometimes less discerning, he said, in their own affairs than in those of others, so that even the most skillful physicians do not run the hazard of prescribing for themselves, but call in the assistance of others when they are indisposed. In the same manner, he, having the fear of God before his eyes, and being afraid to offend him, had decided to bring the question at issue between himself and his son before them, that they might examine the word of God in relation to it, and give their opinion, in writing, what the will of God in such a case might be. He wished also, he said, that the opinion to which they should come should be signed by each one of them individually, with his own hand. He made a similar statement in his address to the Grand Council of Civil Authorities, calling upon them also to give their opinion in respect to what should be done with Alexis. "I beg of you," he said, in the conclusion of his address, "to consider of the affair, to examine it seriously and with attention, and see what it is that our son has deserved, without flattering me, or apprehending that, if in your judgment he deserves no more than slight punishment, it will be disagreeable to me. For I swear to you, by the great God and by his judgments, that you have nothing to fear from me on this account. Neither are you to allow the consideration that it is the son of your sovereign that you are to pass judgment upon to have any effect upon you, but do justice without respect of persons, so that your conscience and mine may not reproach us at the great day of judgment." The convocation of clergy, in deliberating upon the answer which they were to make to the Tsar, deemed it advisable to proceed with great caution. They were not quite willing to recommend directly and openly that Alexis should be put to death, while, at the same time, they wished to give the sanction of their approval for any measures of severity which the Tsar might be inclined to take. So they forbore to express any positive opinion of their own, but contented themselves with looking out in the Scriptures, both in the Old and New Testament, the terrible denunciations which are therein contained against disobedient and rebellious children, and the accounts of fearful punishments which were inflicted upon them in Jewish history. They began their statement by formally acknowledging that Peter himself had absolute power to dispose of the case of his son according to his own sovereign will and pleasure, that they had no jurisdiction in the case, and could not presume to pronounce judgment, or say anything which could in any way restrain or limit the Czar in doing what he judged best. But nevertheless, as the Czar had graciously asked them for their counsel as a means of instructing his own mind previously to coming to a decision, they would proceed to quote from the Holy Scriptures such passages as might be considered to bear upon the subject, and to indicate the will of God in respect to the action of a sovereign and a father in such a case. They then proceeded to quote the texts and passages of Scripture. Some of these texts were denunciations of rebellious and disobedient children, such as "the eye that mocketh his father, and that despiseth to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley shall pluck it out," and the Jewish law providing that, if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, who will not obey the voice of his father, nor the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and mother lay hold of him, and bring him out unto the elders of his city, and unto the gate of his place, and shall say unto the elders of his city, "This our son is rebellious, he will not obey our voice, he is a glutton and a drunkard," and all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. There were other passages quoted relating to his actual cares which occurred in the Jewish history of sons being punished with death for crimes committed against their parents, such as that of Absalom and others. The bearing and tendency of all these extracts from the Scriptures was to justify the severest possible treatment of the unhappy criminal. The bishops added, however, at the close of their communication, that they had made these extracts in obedience to the command of their sovereign, not by way of pronouncing sentence, or making a decree, or in any other way giving any authoritative decision on the question at issue, but only to furnish to the Tsar himself such spiritual guidance and instruction in the case as the word of God afforded. It would be very far from their duty, they said, to condemn anyone to death, for Jesus Christ had taught his ministers not to be governed by a spirit of anger, but by a spirit of meekness. They had no power to condemn anyone to death, or to seek his blood. That, when necessary, was the province of the civil power. Theirs was to bring men to repentance of their sins, and to offer them forgiveness of the same through Jesus Christ their Savior. They therefore, in submitting their communication to his imperial majesty, did it only that he might do what seemed right in his own eyes. If he concludes to punish his fallen son, they said, according to his deeds, and in a manner proportionate to the enormity of his crimes, he has before him the declarations and examples which we have herein drawn from the Scriptures of the Old Testament. If, on the other hand, he is inclined to mercy, he has the example of Jesus Christ, who represented the prodigal son as received and forgiven when he returned and repented, who dismissed the woman taken in adultery when by law she deserved to be stoned, and who said that he would have mercy and not sacrifice. The document concluded by the words, "The heart of the Tsar is in the hand of God, and may he choose the part to which the hand of God shall turn it." As for the other assembly, the one composed of the nobles and senators, and other great civil and military functionaries, before rendering their judgment, they caused Alexis to be brought before them again, in order to call for additional explanations, and to see if he still adhered to the confessions that he had made. At these audiences, Alexis confirmed what he had before said, and acknowledged more freely than he had done before the treasonable intentions of which he had been guilty. His spirit seems by this time to have been completely broken, and he appeared to have thought that the only hope for him of escape from death was in the most humble and abject confessions of earnest supplications for pardon. In these his last confessions, too, he implicated some persons who had not before been accused. One was a certain priest named James. Alexis said that at one time he was confessing to this priest, and, among other sins which he mentioned, he said that he wished for the death of his father. The priest's reply to this was, as Alexis said, "God will pardon you for that, my son, for we all, meaning the priests, wish it too." The priest was immediately arrested, but on being questioned, he denied having made any such reply. The inquisitors then put him to the torture, and there forced from him the admission that he had spoken those words. Whether he had really spoken them, or only admitted it to put an end to the torture, it is impossible to say. They asked him for the names of the persons whom he had heard express a desire that the Tsar should die, but he said he could not recollect. He had heard it from several persons, but he could not remember who they were. He said that Alexis was a great favorite among the people, and that they sometimes used to drink his health under the designation of the Hope of Russia. The Tsar himself also obtained the final and general acknowledgment of guilt from his son, which he sent into the Senate on the day before their judgment was to be rendered. He obtained this confession by sending Tolstoy, an officer of the highest rank in his court, and the person who had been the chief medium of the intercourse and of the communications which he had held with his son during the whole course of the affair, with the following written instructions: To M. Tolstoy, Privy Councillor. Go to my son this afternoon, and put down in writing the answers he shall give to the following questions. 1. What is the reason why he has always been so disobedient to me, and has refused to do what I required of him, or to apply himself to any useful business, notwithstanding all the guilt and shame which he has incurred by so strange and unusual a course? 2. Why is it that he has been so little afraid of me, and has not apprehended the consequences that must inevitably follow from his disobedience? 3. What induced him to desire to secure possession of the crown otherwise than by obedience to me, and following me in the natural order of succession? And examine him upon everything else that bears any relation to this affair. Tolstoy went to Alexis in the prison, and read these questions to him. Alexis wrote out the following statement in reply to them, which Tolstoy carried to the Tsar. 1. Although I was well aware that to be disobedient as I was to my father, and refuse to do what pleased him, was a very strange and unusual course, and both a sin and a shame, yet I was led into it in the first instance in consequence of having been brought up from my infancy with a governess and her maids, from whom I learned nothing but amusements, and diversions, and bigotry, to which I had naturally an inclination. The person to whom I was entrusted after I was removed from my governess gave me no better instructions. My father, afterward being anxious about my education, and desirous that I should apply myself to what became the son of the Tsar, ordered me to learn the German language and other sciences, which I was very averse to. I applied myself to them in a very negligent manner, and only pretended to study at all in order to gain time, and without having any inclination to learn anything. And as my father, who was then frequently with the army, was absent from me a great deal, he ordered His Serene Highness, the Prince Menzikoff, to have an eye upon me. While he was with me, I was obliged to apply myself, but as soon as I was out of his sight, the persons with whom I was left, observing that I was only bent on bigotry and idleness, on keeping company with priests and monks, and drinking with them, they not only encouraged me to neglect my business, but took pleasure in doing as I did. As these persons had been about me from my infancy, I was accustomed to observe their direction, to fear them, and to comply with their wishes in everything, and thus, by degrees, they alienated my affections from my father by diverting me with pleasures of this nature, so that, by little and little, I came to have not only the military affairs and other actions of my father in horror, but also his person itself, which made me always wish to be at a distance from him. Alexander Kikin especially, when he was with me, took a great deal of pains to confirm me in this way of life. My father, having compassion on me, and desiring still to make me worthy of the state to which I was called, sent me into foreign countries, but as I was already grown to man's estate, I made no alteration in my way of living. It is true, indeed, that my travels were of some advantage to me, but they were insufficient to erase the vicious habits which had taken such deep root in me. 2. It was this evil disposition which prevented my being apprehensive of my father's correction for my disobedience. I was really afraid of him, but it was not with a filial fear. I only sought for means to get away from him, and was in no wise concerned to do his will, but to avoid, by every means in my power, what he required of me. Of this I will now freely confess one plain instance. When I came back to Petersburg to my father from abroad, at the end of one of my journeys, he questioned me about my studies, and, among other things, asked me if I had forgotten what I had learned, and I told him no. He then asked me to bring him some of my drawings of plans. Then, fearing that he would order me to draw something in his presence, which I could not do, as I knew nothing of the matter, I set to work to devise a way to hurt my hand, so that it should be impossible for me to do anything at all. So I charged the pistol with a ball, and taking it in my left hand, I let it off against the palm of my right, with a design to have shot through it. The ball entered the wall of my room, and it may be seen there still. My father, observing my hand to be wounded, asked me how it came. I told him an evasive story, and kept the truth to myself. By these means you may see that I was afraid of my father, but not with a proper filial fear. 3. As to my having desired to obtain the crown otherwise than by obedience to my father, and following him in regular order of succession, all the world may easily understand the reason, for when I was once out of the right way, and resolved to imitate my father in nothing, I naturally sought to obtain the succession by any, even the most wrongful method. I confess that I was even willing to come into possession of it by foreign assistance, if it had been necessary. If the emperor had been ready to fulfill the promise that he made me of procuring for me the crown of Russia, even with an armed force, I should have spared nothing to have obtained it. For instance, if the emperor had demanded that I should afterward furnish him with Russian troops against any of his enemies, in exchange for his service in aiding me, or large sums of money, I should have done whatever he pleased. I would have given great presents to his ministers and generals over and above. In a word, I would have thought nothing too much to have obtained my desire. The confession, after it was brought to the Tsar by Tolstoy, to whom Alexis gave it, was sent by him to the Great Council of State to aid them in forming their opinion. The council were occupied for the space of a week in hearing the case, and then they drew up and signed their decision. The statement which they made began by acknowledging that they had not of themselves any original right to try such a question, the Tsar himself, according to the ancient constitution of the empire, having sole and exclusive jurisdiction in all such affairs, without being beholden to his subjects in regard to them in any manner whatever. But nevertheless, as the Tsar had deemed it expedient to refer it to them, they accepted the responsibility, and, after having fully investigated the case, were now ready to pronounce judgment. They then proceeded to declare that, after a full hearing and careful consideration of all the evidence, both oral and written, which had been laid before them, including the confessions of Alexis himself, they found that he had been guilty of treason and rebellion against his father and sovereign, and deserved to suffer death. And although, said the council in continuation, although both before and since his return to Russia, the Tsar his father had promised him pardon on certain conditions, yet those conditions were particularly and expressly specified, especially the one which provided that he should make a full and complete confession of all his designs, and of the names of all the persons who had been privy to them, or concerned in the execution of them. With these conditions, and particularly the last, Alexis had not complied, but had returned insincere and evasive answers to the questions which had been put to him, and had concealed not only the names of a great many of the principal persons that were involved in the conspiracy, but also the most important designs and intentions of the conspirators, thus making it appear that he had determined to reserve to himself an opportunity hereafter, when a favorable occasion should present itself, of resuming his designs and putting his wicked enterprise into execution against his sovereign and father. He thus had rendered himself unworthy of the pardon which his father had promised him, and had forfeited all claim to it. The sentence of the council concluded in the following words: "It is with hearts full of affliction and eyes streaming down with tears that we, as subjects and servants, pronounce this sentence, considering that, being such, it does not belong to us to enter into a judgment of so great importance, and particularly to pronounce sentence against the son of the most mighty and merciful Tsar our Lord. However, since it has been his will that we should enter into judgment, we herein declare our real opinion, and pronounce this condemnation with a conscience so pure and Christian that we think we can answer for it at the terrible, just, and impartial judgment of the great God. To conclude, we submit the sentence which we now give, and the condemnation which we make, to the sovereign power and will, and to the merciful review of his Tsarian Majesty, our most merciful monarch." This document was signed in the most solemn manner by all the members of the council, nearly 100 in number. Among the signatures are the names of a great number of ministers of state, counselors, senators, governors, generals, and other personages of high civil and military rank. The document, when thus formally authenticated, was sent with much solemn and imposing ceremony to the Tsar. The Tsar, after an interval of great suspense and solicitude, during which he seems to have endured much mental suffering, confirmed the judgment of the council, and a day was appointed on which Alexis was to be arraigned, in order that sentence of death, in accordance with it, might be solemnly pronounced upon him. The day appointed was the 6th of July, nearly a fortnight after the judgment of the court was rendered to the Tsar. The length of this delay indicates a severe struggle in the mind of the Tsar between his pride and honor of a sovereign, feelings which prompted him to act in the most determined and rigorous manner in punishing a rebel against his government, and what still remained of his parental affection for his son. He knew well that after what had passed, there could never be any true and genuine reconciliation, and that as long as his son lived, his name would be the watchword of opposition and rebellion and his very existence would act as a potent and perpetual stimulus to the treasonable designs which the foes of civilization and progress were always disposed to form. He finally, therefore, determined that the sentence of death should at least be pronounced. What his intention was in respect to the actual execution of it can never be known. When the appointed day arrived, a grand session of the council was convened, and Alexis was brought out from the fortress where he was imprisoned, and arraigned before it for the last time. He was attended by a strong guard. On being placed at the bar of the tribunal, he was called upon to repeat the confessions which he had made, and then the sentence of death, as it had been sent to the Tsar, was read to him. He was then taken back again to his prison as before. Alexis was overwhelmed with terror and distress at finding himself thus condemned, and the next morning intelligence was brought to the Tsar that, after suffering convulsions at intervals through the night, he had fallen into an apoplectic fit. About noon another message was brought, saying that he had revived in some measure from the fit, yet his vital powers seemed to be sinking away, and the physician thought that his life was in great danger. The Tsar sent for the principal ministers of state to come to him, and he waited with them in great anxiety and agitation for further tidings. At length, a third messenger came, and said that it was thought that Alexis could not possibly outlive the evening, and that he longed to see his father. The Tsar immediately requested the ministers to accompany him, and set out from his palace to go to the fortress where Alexis was confined. On entering the room where his dying son was lying, he was greatly moved, and Alexis himself, bursting into tears, folded his hands and began to entreat his father's forgiveness for his sins against him. He said that he had grievously and heinously offended the majesty of God Almighty and of the Tsar, that he hoped he should not recover from his illness, for if he should recover, he should feel that he was unworthy to live. But he begged and implored his father, for God's sake, to take off the curse that he had pronounced against him, to forgive him for all the heinous crimes which he had committed, to bestow upon him his paternal blessing, and to cause prayers to be put up for his soul. While Alexis was speaking thus, the Tsar himself and all the ministers and officers who had come with him were melted in tears. The Tsar replied kindly to him. He referred, it is true, to the sins and crimes of which Alexis had been guilty, but he gave him his forgiveness and his blessing, and then took his leave with tears and lamentations which rendered it impossible for him to speak, and in which all present joined. The scene was heartrending. At 5 o'clock in the evening, a major of the guards came across the water from the fortress to the Tsar's palace with a message that Alexis was extremely desirous to see his father once more. The Tsar was at first unwilling to comply with this request. He could not bear, he thought, to renew the pain of such an interview, but his ministers advised him to go. They represented to him that it was hard to deny such a request from his dying son, who was probably tormented by the stings of a guilty conscience, and felt relieved and comforted when his father was near. So Peter consented to go. But just as he was going on board the boat which was to take him over to the fortress, another messenger came saying that it was too late. Alexis had expired. On the next day after the death of his son, the Tsar, in order to anticipate and preclude the false rumors in respect to the case which he knew that his enemies would endeavor to spread throughout the continent, caused a brief but full statement of his trial and condemnation, and of the circumstances of his death, to be drawn up and sent to all his ministers abroad, in order that they might communicate the facts in an authentic form to the courts to which they were respectfully accredited. The 9th day of July, the 3rd day after the death of Alexis, was appointed for the funeral. The body was laid in a coffin covered with black velvet. A pall of rich gold tissue was spread over the coffin, and in this way the body was conveyed to the Church of the Holy Trinity, where it was laid in state. It remained in this condition during the remainder of that day and all of the next, and also on the 3rd day until evening. It was visited by vast crowds of people, who were permitted to come up and kiss the hands of the deceased. On the evening of the 3rd day after the body was conveyed to the church, the funeral service was performed, and the body was conveyed to the tomb. A large procession, headed by the Tsar, the Tsarina, and all the chief nobility of the court, followed in the funeral train. The Tsar and all the other mourners carried in their hands a small wax taper burning. The ladies were all dressed in black silks. It was said by those who were near enough in the procession to observe the Tsar that he went weeping all the way. At the service in the church, a funeral sermon was pronounced by the priest from the very appropriate text, O Absalom, my son Absalom. Thus ended this dreadful tragedy. The party who had been opposed to the reforms and improvements of the Tsar seems to have become completely disorganized after the death of Alexis, and they never again attempted to organize any resistance to Peter's plans. Indeed, most of the principal leaders had been executed or banished to Siberia. As to Arakesa, the first wife of the Tsar, and the mother of Alexis, who was proved to have been privy to his designs, she was sent away to a strong castle, and shut up for the rest of her days in a dungeon. So close was her confinement that even her food was put into her through a hole in the wall. It remains only to say one word in conclusion in respect to Afrosinia. When Alexis was first arrested, it was supposed that she, having been the slave and companion of Alexis, was a party with him in his treasonable designs. But in the course of the examinations, it appeared very fully that whatever of connection with the affair or participation in it she may have had was involuntary and innocent, and the testimony which she gave was of great service in unraveling the mystery of the whole transaction. In the end, the Tsar expressed his satisfaction with her conduct in strong terms. He gave her a full pardon for the involuntary aid which she had rendered Alexis in carrying out his plans. He ordered everything which had been taken away from her to be restored, made her presents of handsome jewelry, and said that if she would like to be married, he would give her a handsome portion out of the royal treasury. But she promptly declined this proposal. "I have been compelled," she said, "to yield to one man's will by force. Henceforth, no other shall ever come near my side." End of chapter 18.
Through the long night that is mankind's spiritual infancy, music is our fire, and literature is the wolf curled up beside her. This is 100.5 FM, Radio Lillooet, bringing you both since the turn of the millennium.
Peter the Great by Jacob Abbott. Chapter 19. Conclusion. At the time of the death of Alexis, the Tsar's hopes in respect to a successor fell upon his little son, Peter Petrowitz, the child of Catherine, who was born about the time of the death of Alexis's wife, when the difficulties between himself and Alexis were first beginning to assume an alarming form. This child was now about 3 years old, but he was of a very weak and sickly constitution, and the Tsar watched him with fear and trembling. His apprehensions proved to be well-founded, for about a year after the unhappy death of Alexis, he also died. Peter was entirely overwhelmed with grief at this new calamity. He was seized with the convulsions to which he was subject when under any strong excitement. His face was distorted, and his neck was twisted and stiffened in a most frightful manner. In ordinary attacks of this kind, Catherine had power to soothe and allay the spasmodic action of the muscles, and gradually release her husband from the terrible grip of the disease. But now he would not suffer her to come near him. He could not endure it, for the sight of her renewed so vividly the anguish that he felt for the loss of their child, that it made the convulsions and the suffering worse than before. It is said that on this occasion Peter shut himself up alone for 3 days and three nights in his own chamber, where he lay stretched on the ground in anguish and agony, and would not allow anybody to come in. At length one of his ministers of state came, and, speaking to him through the door, appealed to him, in a most earnest manner, to come forth and give them directions in respect to the affairs of the empire, which, he said, urgently required his attention. The minister had brought with him a large number of senators to support and enforce his appeal. At length the Tsar allowed the door to be opened, and the minister, with all the senators, came together into the room. The sudden appearance of so many persons, and the boldness of the minister in taking this decided step, made such an impression on the mind of the Tsar as to divert his mind for the moment from his grief, and he allowed himself to be led forth, and to be persuaded to take some food. The death of Petrowitz took place in 1719, and the Tsar continued to live and reign himself after this period for about 6 years. During all that time he went on vigorously and successfully in completing the reforms which he had undertaken in the internal condition of his empire, and increasing the power and influence of his government among the surrounding nations. He had no further serious difficulty with the opponents of his policy, though he was always under apprehensions that difficulties might arise after his death. He had the right, according to the ancient constitution of the monarchy, to designate his own successor, choosing for this purpose either one of his sons or any other person. And now, since both his sons were dead, his mind revolved anxiously the question what provision he should make for the government of the empire after his decease. He finally concluded to leave it in the hands of Catherine herself, and to prepare the way for this, he resolved to cause her to be solemnly crowned empress during his lifetime. As a preliminary measure, however, before publicly announcing Catherine as his intended successor, Peter required all the officers of the empire, both civil and military, and all the nobles and other chief people in the country, to subscribe a solemn declaration and oath that they acknowledged the right of the Tsar to appoint his successor, and that after his death they would sustain and defend whomsoever he should name as their emperor and sovereign. This declaration, printed forms of which were sent all over the kingdom, was signed by the people very readily. No one, however, imagined that Catherine would be the person on whom the Tsar's choice would fall. It was generally supposed that a certain Prince Narishkin would be appointed to the succession. The Tsar himself said nothing of his intention, but waited until the time should arrive for carrying it into effect. The first step to be taken in carrying the measure into effect was to issue a grand proclamation announcing his design and explaining the reasons for it. In this proclamation, Peter cited many instances from history in which great sovereigns had raised their consorts to a seat on the throne beside them, and then he recapitulated the great services which Catherine had rendered to him and to the state, which made her peculiarly deserving of such an honor. She had been a tried and devoted friend and counselor to him, he said, for many years. She had shared his labors and fatigues, and had accompanied him on his journeys, and had even repeatedly encountered all the discomforts and dangers of the camp in following him in his military campaigns. By so doing, she had rendered him the most essential service, and on one occasion she had been the means of saving his whole army from destruction. He therefore declared his intention of joining her with himself in the supreme power, and to celebrate this event by a solemn coronation. The place where the coronation was to be performed was, of course, the ancient city of Moscow, and commands were issued to all the great dignitaries of the church and state, and invitations to all the foreign ambassadors to repair to that city and be ready on the appointed day to take part in the ceremony. It would be impossible to describe or conceive, without witnessing it, the gorgeousness and splendor of the spectacle which the coronation afforded. The scene of the principal ceremony was the cathedral, which was magnificently decorated for the occasion. The whole interior of the building was illuminated with an immense number of wax candles, contained in chandeliers and branches of silver and gold, which were suspended from the arches or attached to the walls. The steps of the altar, and all that part of the pavement of the church over which the Tsarina would have to walk in the performance of the ceremonies, were covered with rich tapestry embroidered with gold, and the seats on which the bishops and other ecclesiastical dignitaries were to sit were covered with crimson cloth. The ceremony of the coronation itself was to be performed on a dais, or raised platform, which was set up in the middle of the church. This platform, with the steps leading to it, was carpeted with crimson velvet, and it was surmounted by a splendid canopy made of silk, embroidered with gold. The canopy was ornamented, too, on every side with fringes, ribbons, tufts, tassels, and gold lace, in the richest manner. Under the canopy was the double throne for the emperor and empress, and near it seats for the royal princesses, all covered with crimson velvet trimmed in gold. When the appointed hour arrived, the procession was formed at the royal palace and moved toward the cathedral through a dense and compact mass of spectators that everywhere thronged the way. Every window was filled, and the housetops, wherever there was space for a footing, were crowded. There were troops of guards mounted on horseback and splendidly caparisoned. There were bands of music and heralds, and great officers of state bearing successively on cushions ornamented with gold and jewels the imperial mantle, the globe, the scepter, and the crown. In this way, the royal party proceeded to the cathedral, and there, after going through a great many ceremonies, which, from the magnificence of the dresses, of the banners, and the various regal emblems that were displayed, was very gorgeous to behold, but which it would be tedious to describe, the crown was placed upon Catharine's head, the moment being signalized to all Moscow by the ringing of bells, the music of trumpets and drums, and the firing of cannon. The ceremonies were continued through 2 days by several other imposing processions, and were closed on the night of the second day by a grand banquet held in a spacious hall, which was magnificently decorated for the occasion. And while the regal party within the hall were being served with the richest viands from the golden vessels, the populace without were feasted by means of oxen roasted whole in the streets, and public fountains made to run with exhaustless supplies of wine. The coronation of Catharine as empress was not a mere ceremony. There were connected with it formal legal arrangements for transferring the supreme power into her hands on the death of the Tsar. Nor were these arrangements made any too soon, for it was less than a year after that time that the Tsar, in the midst of great ceremonies of rejoicing connected with the betrothal of one of his daughters, the Princess Anna Petrovna, to a foreign duke, was attacked suddenly by a very painful disease, and, after suffering great distress and anguish for many days, he at length expired. His death took place on the 28th of January, 1725. One of his daughters, the Princess Natalia Petrovna, the third of Catherine's children, died a short time after her father, and the bodies of both parent and child were interred together at the same formal ceremony, which was conducted with the utmost pomp and parade. The obsequies were so protracted that it was more than 6 weeks from the death of the Tsar before the bodies were finally committed to the tomb, and a volume might be filled with an account of the processions, the ceremonies, the prayers, the chantings, the costumes, the plumes and trappings of horses, the sledges decked in mourning, the requiem sung, the salvos of artillery fired, and all the various other displays and doings connected with the occasion. Thus was brought to an end the earthly personal career of Peter the Great. He well deserves his title, for he was certainly one of the greatest as well as one of the most extraordinary men that ever lived. Himself half a savage, he undertook to civilize 20 million people, and he pursued the work during his whole lifetime through dangers, difficulties, and discouragements, which it required a surprising degree of determination and energy to surmount. He differs from other great military monarchs that have appeared from time to time in world history, and by their exploits have secured for themselves the title of the Great, in this, that while they acquired their renown by conquests gained over foreign nations, which, in most cases, after the death of their conquerors, lapsed again into their original condition, leaving no permanent results behind, the triumphs which Peter achieved were the commencement of a work of internal improvement and reform which is now, after the lapse of a century and a half since he commenced it, still going on. The work is, in fact, advancing at the present day with perhaps greater and more successful progress than ever before. Notwithstanding the stern severity of Peter's character, the terrible violence of his passions, and the sort of savage grandeur which marked all his great determinations and plans, there was a certain vein of playfulness running through his mind, and when he was in a jocose or merry humor, no one could be more jocose and merry than he. The interest which he took in the use of tools, and in working with his own hands at various handicrafts, his notion of entering the army as a drummer, the navy as a midshipman, and rising gravely, by regular promotion in both services, through all the grades, the way in which he often amused himself when on his travels in going about in disguise among all sorts of people, and a thousand other circumstances which are related of him by historians, are indications of what might be called a sort of boyish spirit, which strongly marked his character, and was seen continually coming out into action during the whole course of his life. It was only 2 years before his death that a striking instance of this occurred. The first vessel that was built in Russia was a small skiff, which was planned and built almost entirely by Peter's own hands. This skiff was built at Moscow, where it remained for 20 or 30 years an object, all this time in Peter's mind, of special affection and regard. At length, when the naval power of the empire was firmly established, Peter conceived the idea of removing this skiff from Moscow to Petersburg, and consecrating it solemnly there as a sort of souvenir to be preserved forever in commemoration of the small beginnings from which all the naval greatness of the empire had sprung. The name which he had given to the skiff was the Little Grandfather, the name denoting that the little craft, frail and insignificant as it was the parent and progenitor of all the great frigates and ships of the line which were then at anchor in the roads about Kronstadt and off the mouth of the Neva. A grand ceremony was accordingly arranged for the consecration of the Little Grandfather. The little vessel was brought in triumph from Moscow to Petersburg, where it was put on board a sort of barge or galliot to be taken to Kronstadt. All the great officers of state and all the foreign ministers were invited to be present at the consecration. The company embarked on board yachts provided for them, and went down the river following the Little Grandfather, which was borne on its galliot in the van, drums beating, trumpets sounding, and banners waving all the way. The next day the whole fleet, which had been collected in the bay for this purpose, was arranged in the form of an amphitheater. The Little Grandfather was let down from its galliot into the water. The emperor went on board of it. He was accompanied by the admirals and vice-admirals of the fleet, who were to serve as crew. The admiral stationed himself at the helm to steer, and the vice-admirals took the oars. These grand officials were not required, however, to do much hard work at rowing, for there were two shallops provided, manned by strong men, to tow the skiff. In this way, the skiff rowed to and fro over the sea, and then passed along the fleet, saluted everywhere by the shouts of the crews upon the yards and in the rigging, and by the guns of the ships. 3,000 guns were discharged by the ships in these salvos in honor of their humble progenitor. The Little Grandfather returned the salutes of the guns with great spirit by means of 3 small swivels which had been placed on board. The Empress Catherine saw the show from an elevation on the shore, where she sat with the ladies of her court in a pavilion or tent which had been erected for the purpose. At the close of the ceremonies, the skiff was deposited with great ceremony in the place which had been prepared to receive it in the castle of Kronstadt, and there, when one more day had been spent in banquetings and rejoicings, the company left the Little Grandfather to its repose, and returned in their yachts to the town. Not many days after the death of Peter, Catherine, in accordance with the arrangements that Peter had previously made, was proclaimed empress by a solemn act of the Senate and ministers of state, and she at once entered upon the exercise of the sovereign power. She signalized her accession by a great many acts of clemency, liberating prisoners, recalling exiles, removing bodies from gibbets and wheels, and heads from poles, and delivering them to friends for burial, remitting the sentence of death pronounced upon political offenders, and otherwise mitigating and assuaging sufferings which Peter's remorseless ideas of justice and retribution had caused. Catherine did not, however, live long to exercise her beneficial power. She died suddenly about 2 years after her husband, and was buried with great pomp in a grand monumental tomb in one of the churches of St. Petersburg, which she had been engaged ever since his death in constructing for him. End of Peter the Great by Jacob Abbott. Recording by Russ Lemker of Edina, Minnesota.
Ladies and gentlemen, join us again next week for another Radio Lillooet special presentation.